Welcome to Island Crimes and Mysteries. And now, it's time to join your host, Newells, for another episode.
Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of Ireland Crimes and Mysteries. I want to thank you for joining me today, and if you're a returning listener, I want to say a big thank you for your continued support. If this is your first time listening to my podcast, welcome. It's great to have you on board. So without further ado, let's get started on today's story. Today's case takes us back to the Phoenix Park in Dublin City, which I have covered in a previous podcast, and then to Edenderry, a town in North County Offaly and near the borders of neighbouring counties Kildare, Meath and Westmeath. Both these locations in 1982 would be the subject of two separate heinous crimes that would eventually be linked and go down in history, as they would lead to a manhunt that was not only news because of the crimes involved, but also for the fact that the case would also end the tenure of the sitting government. This crime became known by the term Gooboo: grotesque, unbelievable, bizarre and unprecedented. To understand the crimes and remember the victims, we first have to talk about a man named Malcolm MacArthur. Malcolm MacArthur was born on the 17th of April 1945 into a wealthy farming family and grew up in Meath. He had lived a privileged life. He was the only son, and his father was known to have been allegedly a violent man towards him. Known as an eccentric person, MacArthur was in early 1982 living in Tenerife with his partner and seven-year-old son. Money was tight. Previously, he had accumulated a sizable amount of money from an inheritance from the sale of his late father's lands in 1971. 70,000 Irish punts, to be precise, which in today's money would be nearly €1 million. He ploughed through this money at an extraordinary rate. He was living the high life and was known as a bit of a man about town, mixing in high society circles in Dublin's social scene of the 70s. By 1982, when he was living in Tenerife with his partner and son, this money was starting to dwindle. So he told his partner he had to go to Switzerland to sort out some money issues. Instead, he headed to Dublin, his partner unaware of the fact that he was going to Dublin. But unlike any normal person in these circumstances, MacArthur, instead of looking for a job, decided the best course of action would be to rob a bank. And of course, he would need a getaway car and a gun to make this happen. First, he decided to buy a hammer. Next on the list was a car, and he was willing to do whatever it would take to get one, even kill. So he would need to acquire a gun. After looking through the newspaper, he responded to an ad in the paper by a man named Donal Dunn from Edenderry, County Offaly, who had a gun for sale. But MacArthur would need transport to drive from Dublin to Edenderry and decided he needed to steal a car. And so with that, he set about putting his next plan into motion. The 22nd of July 1982 was a warm, balmy day in Dublin City, and Bridie Gargan, who was a 27-year-old nurse, was in the Phoenix Park soaking up the sun on a rare day off from work. At the same time, Malcolm MacArthur was walking around the park looking for a suitable victim from whom he could steal a car. He looked very out of place on such a hot day, as he was wearing heavy winter-type clothing and a hat. As he walked around the park, he spotted Bridie sunbathing beside her car and decided she would be an easy target. But he had underestimated Bridie's fighting spirit. She was not going to let him just walk over and steal her car while she watched on. She was going to fight back. An altercation broke out between the pair, which was witnessed by a man named Paddy Byrne. Paddy worked as a gardener at the US Embassy and had just finished work at 5 p.m. He was walking home to the embassy bungalow where he lived when he noticed what he described as a bearded man slinking from tree to tree in the direction of a parked car. The car was parked on Chesterfield Avenue, and he would see a young woman nearby sunbathing. Mr. Byrne described what he saw by saying, quote, I saw this guy who was dressed a bit strange with a hat and heavy pullover on such a hot day. I saw him hiding and going from tree to tree and going towards the car. When Miss Gargan went to her car, MacArthur followed her and sat beside her, and the two became animated. Paddy said he initially thought it was just a lover's quarrel. He went on to say he started pulling her hair and began punching her in the side of the head. It was when Paddy saw this he decided he needed to intervene. He had thought he was using his fist to hit her initially, but as he drew closer to the car, he saw it was actually a lump hammer. Paddy said, "I went to the car and decided to challenge him." Ms. Gargan was by now in the back seat of the car with a newspaper over her head. Paddy said he could hear her crying. Next thing he knew, MacArthur pulled a gun on him and was telling him to back off or I'll put a bullet in you. Paddy then attempted to grab the gun from MacArthur, but his hands were sweating and he lost his grip, saying, "I couldn't hold on to him. He ran at me again with the gun and I told him I was going. He kept coming at me and I lost my footing and slipped into a ditch." Paddy said that what he saw in the back seat of the car will never leave him. He said Bridie was attempting to talk despite her injuries and being semi-conscious. He went on to say, quote, "There was blood everywhere. As MacArthur was getting out of the car, the newspaper used to cover Bridie had slipped off, and it was like someone had thrown a bucket of tomatoes all around her head and face. It was dreadful." The gun would later turn out to have been a replica gun. After threatening Paddy, MacArthur jumped back into the car and drove off. Paddy said, "The car drove off in a fog of dust." As this was a time before mobile phones, Paddy was desperately trying to flag down a car to get help, but no one would stop. That was until a colleague of his saw him and pulled over. Paddy told him what had happened and pointed at the car off in the distance. They decided to give chase, but the car was way too far ahead, and eventually they lost sight of it. Then an ambulance that passed the car MacArthur was driving spotted a hospital sticker on the windscreen and, assuming it was a doctor trying to get a patient to hospital, put their sirens and lights on and decided to escort the car to the nearest hospital, which was St. James's Hospital near Kilmainham. MacArthur did follow the ambulance all the way to the hospital entrance, but as the ambulance entered the hospital grounds, MacArthur turned the car around and headed out towards Rialto. This is where he abandoned the car, on the South Circular Road. This was also where Bridie would later be found barely conscious on the back seat a few hours later. She was rushed to hospital, but died 4 days later. The whole country was shocked and saddened by these events. A nationwide hunt for the perpetrator got underway immediately. People felt unsafe, many thinking, if this could happen to someone in broad daylight in a busy park, no one was safe. MacArthur was now on the run, but not willing to give up on his notion of robbing a bank to fund his lavish lifestyle. But he still needed a real gun. This was when he saw the advertisement for the gun made by Donal Dunn in the Evening Press newspaper. He answered the ad and told Donal he would come to collect the gun and pay him. He hopped on a bus to Finglas, where he casually walked into the toilets of the Finglas House pub on Glasnevin Avenue and shaved off his beard. He then took a bus to Tullamore in County Offaly. Gardaí believe he hitchhiked the rest of the journey to Edenderry, where he spent the night on the harbour in Edenderry. He went to a local shop the next morning and purchased a carton of milk and the Sunday Independent newspaper, which had on its front page an article on Bridie's murder, stating that she was still in a very critical condition. It was the following day that Bridie would die from her injuries. Donal Dunn was a young farmer from Edenderry. On his way to meet MacArthur, Donal stopped into his brother Christopher's house and was telling him he had sold the gun and was heading in to do the exchange. Christopher offered to go with him, but Donal declined the offer, saying he would call in on the way back. That was the last time Christopher would ever see his brother alive. When Donal met MacArthur, he showed him how to use the shotgun. But rather than thank him and pay for the gun, Once MacArthur knew how to use it, he turned around, pointed the gun towards Donal, and shot him with his own gun. Donal died instantly from his injuries. MacArthur knew he didn't have the funds to pay for the gun, so the only way to get away, in his mind, was to kill Donal. He then fled the scene in Dunn's car and headed back to Dublin. This was 3 days after he had attacked and killed Bridie. Both murders were described at the time as utterly cold-blooded. MacArthur seemed willing to get rid of anyone that stood in his way. Donal's car was later found near the Central Bank on Dame Street in Dublin. At the time, Gardaí did not put the two murders together and were investigating them as two separate incidents. The country, as I said, was on high alert. Eventually, Gardaí would connect the two killings as the attacker had taken their victim's car on both occasions. Gardaí were, though, intrigued by the similar description of the killer in the Phoenix Park and that of the man spotted on the harbour in Edenderry, and later seen with Donal. Certain people in Dublin also had their suspicions about MacArthur. He did stand out from the regular crowd. The owner of a local newsagent in Dunleary, where MacArthur frequented, had noticed he was growing a beard. And when he heard the description of the man, he became suspicious. And as we know, he would later shave off that beard in an attempt to change his appearance. He had also been noticed by gun enthusiasts in Dublin and Meath, hanging around the gun range. He would sit on a seat at the range just watching people firing off rounds. They again said he stood out, firstly because they did not know him, and secondly because of the unusual way he would dress. It was only after Gardaí in Edenderry filmed a reconstruction of Donal Dunn's movements a week after his murder that several witnesses came forward to say they saw him with a strange man. They said this man was wearing a tweed overcoat, peaked cap, dark pants, and thick horn-rimmed glasses. They said he had a cultured accent which stood out to the locals in County Offaly. An office worker at the bus station in Dublin also gave a similar description of a man asking for bus times shortly after Bridie's murder. The similarities of both descriptions piqued the interest of the Gardaí and gave them a clear link between the two murders. Gardaí would also find the discarded Sunday Independent in a bin on the harbour in Edenderry, and from this would lift a fingerprint belonging to MacArthur. This fingerprint would be a match for a fingerprint found on polythene that was wrapped around a shovel that had been left at the scene of Bridie's attack in the Phoenix Park. But despite all this evidence, Gardaí had still not identified MacArthur as the person responsible for the two murders. MacArthur, meanwhile, seemed to be getting deeper into his obsession and trying to come up with another way of getting money. In a move that would ultimately be the beginning of his downfall, he made his way to the house of a man named Harry Beeling in Killiney in Dublin, in Donal Dunn's car. He was a former American diplomat. Seemingly the two had met at a party 8 years previous. Beeling recognised MacArthur and invited him in straight away. Once in the house, MacArthur pulled out the gun, pointed it at Beeling and told him he was going to rob him, holding him at gunpoint for several hours. Beeling, in an effort to distract MacArthur, told him his checkbook was upstairs, and to his surprise, MacArthur allowed him to go upstairs to retrieve it. As Beeling came down the stairs, he could not see MacArthur, who was in another room. So Beeling took his chance and made his escape. He ran to a neighbour's house and started banging on their door for help. When the neighbour answered the door, Beeling explained to him what had just happened and that he needed to ring the guards immediately. MacArthur, realising that Beeling had just escaped to the neighbour's house, made his own escape. But in a bizarre twist, the following morning, MacArthur would call the Gardaí about the incident. He told the Gardaí it was all just a joke, a massive misunderstanding. Gardaí by now had MacArthur's name after several phone calls from witnesses and people that had crossed paths with him. They were astounded by the phone call. It appeared MacArthur was descending into some sort of manic state as his actions became more desperate and he realised he was a wanted man. This call did, however, convince Gardaí that they were on the right track and that MacArthur was their man. At this stage, they knew he was responsible for both murders. But the problem was they did not know much about the man, so they set about building a profile of him. They would have to be quick, though, as MacArthur seemed unhinged. And now that they knew he was responsible for double murder and had went to a person's house and threatened them at gunpoint, they knew no one was safe. But yet again, MacArthur was about to put a new plan into action as he tried to evade capture. He knew a man named Patrick Connolly, who just happened to be the Attorney General or the Chief Legal Advisor to the Irish government. They would have socialised in the same circles back in the 1970s. MacArthur rang Patrick and told him he was in town and that he would be around for a few days as he had some financial affairs to attend to. Patrick, who considered MacArthur an old friend, invited him to stay at his house in Dalkey while he attended to these affairs. At first, MacArthur declined, saying he did not want to intrude on his privacy. He added, as he spoke to Patrick, that he had been staying with a friend in Trinity for a few days. Patrick told him there would be no problem with him staying, and he would not regard having him at the house as intruding on his privacy in any way. So MacArthur went to stay with the Attorney General. It was August 1982 and the All-Ireland Hurling semi-final between Galway and Kilkenny was scheduled to be played at Croke Park. The Attorney General had VIP tickets to the game and invited MacArthur along. Whatever possessed MacArthur to accept the offer, we will never know. But nonetheless, MacArthur headed to Croke Park with the Attorney General in a Garda-driven state car with the very detectives that were hunting him down. He couldn't make it up. They sat in the VIP box, only a few seats away from, wait till you hear, the Garda Commissioner. I kid you not. Then on the 13th of August 1982, just 3 weeks after he had attacked Bridie, things started to go wrong for Malcolm MacArthur as the net began to close in on him and the investigation that the Gardaí were carrying out would bring them to the front door of the Attorney General's house, to the very dismay of all involved. Patrick Connolly would write in his diary for that very day, "When I came home this evening ready to pack for my holidays, I found that there were detectives waiting to arrest Malcolm MacArthur. The most shattering day of my life. He is to answer for two murders of a violent nature. Unbelievable news." Patrick would later say, "I went in trying to pull myself together, as it were, and to him I said, 'I don't know what this is about, Malcolm, but whatever it is, you're on your own.' And he said, 'Fine.'" Malcolm had been in the house on his own when the detectives arrived at Patrick Connolly's house, and he refused to let them in. It was only when the Attorney General arrived home that he agreed to let them in, and he was immediately arrested. The already unbelievable 3 weeks had ended as bizarrely as they had begun, with the arrest taking place at the Attorney General and legal advisor to the Irish government's house. Patrick Connolly was a close friend of the then Taoiseach Charles Haughey. Taoiseach, which literally translates to the word chief, was the Irish Prime Minister. Suddenly, Irish politics was embroiled in a double murder. This was unprecedented. Later on the same evening of Friday the 13th, another bizarre coincidence if you are of a suspicious nature, Patrick Connolly rang on Taoiseach Charles Haughey. He explained to him what had happened that day and that he still intended on going on holidays the next day. Why he thought this was a good idea, or why he was not ordered by an Taoiseach to remain in the country to give a full statement to the Gardaí, we will never know. It would later be written in the papers that the phone line had a bad connection and an Taoiseach did not get the significance of what was after transpiring that day. An Taoiseach would say that the enormity of the situation did not hit him until the following day. But it was too late to rectify the situation, as the papers were full of headlines that the Attorney General had gone off on holidays to America the day after the perpetrator of a double murder was arrested in his house. People could not believe that An Taoiseach had allowed him to leave the country under such extraordinary circumstances. But nonetheless, that's what happened. The story was quickly becoming a scandal in the press, and An Taoiseach beginning to feel the pressure. He ordered Patrick Connolly to come home from his holiday in America.
When I learned the full facts on Saturday, then I decided that he should return, and I suggested to him that he do so. But after all, as I say, he is a major constitutional person. Normally in those circumstances, it is to him I would turn for advice as to what should happen. So that in the circumstances, when he said to me that he would prefer to go on to New York and think about the situation and deal with it from there, I agreed.
It would later emerge that they had spoken on the phone three times before he was told to return. The government failed to come clean about this fact. This oversight did not help the government, as people had their suspicions that they knew more than they were telling, and that maybe, just maybe, Patrick Connolly had known all along who he was keeping in his house. It would, however, later emerge that he was in fact totally innocent and didn't know anything about the heinous crimes that had been committed by Malcolm MacArthur. Once it became clear that Connolly was blameless, public attention switched to An Taoiseach. People began to wonder, did he know more than he was letting on? What had he to do with all that had happened? The following day was Saturday the 14th of August, and this was the day that Malcolm MacArthur was charged at Dunleary District Court. Crowds had gathered outside the courthouse waiting to catch a glimpse of MacArthur, when suddenly two detectives, escorting a man with a blanket over his head and his hands in his pocket, walked into the courthouse. People would later say that Malcolm MacArthur looked very calm and didn't show any fear, and strolled into the courthouse like he was going into a restaurant for a meal. It was remarked that occasionally he would be seen peering out from under the blanket, looking at the ever-increasing crowd who by now had started jeering and shouting at MacArthur. He was wearing a tweed jacket, flannel trousers and a pair of brogues as he strolled into the courthouse. One reporter remarking that it was like as if he didn't realise what was at stake, that he was about to lose his freedom, saying it was like he didn't care, an attitude that he would continue with throughout any court proceedings, giving off the attitude that he was better than everyone else. That very night, Patrick Connolly arrived back in the country. He was immediately driven out to Kinsealy, the home of An Taoiseach, where he handed in his resignation. In his resignation statement, he would say the following. At no time have I had any knowledge whatsoever of the fact that the Gardaí were trying to find him in relation to the offence which he has now been charged. At no time did I have any occasion to entertain any such suspicion. The events which have taken place have taken me wholly by surprise and come as a very great personal shock to me. His very association with MacArthur had ruined his career, whether he knew or not, and to be fair to him, I'm assuming he didn't know, it was his downfall. But this was not the end of the matter when it came to the government. The state of the Irish government at the time was on tenterhooks, to say the very least. People had already been losing confidence in them. Lots of underhand and shady stuff had been going on, like the government ministers asking An Garda Síochána to bug reporters' telephones without any concrete reason to do so. This scandal alone would have been enough for people to lose confidence in the government. But Gardaí had not made anyone in the government aware that night of the arrest at the Attorney General's house, and that included An Taoiseach. This fact was true. But because of the tender political atmosphere at the time, people were slow to believe this fact. The atmosphere within the government and all the different political parties was very tense, with opposition parties demanding clarification on how much the government actually knew about what had transpired at the Attorney General's house. On Tuesday, the 17th of August, on Taoiseach Charlie Haughey held a press conference. It was at this press conference that he uttered the now infamous words, grotesque, unbelievable, bizarre and unprecedented. He said at the press conference, "This is a situation that none of us have ever experienced before. I don't think anyone in this room has ever had such an experience of such an unprecedented situation." And he did look in total shock and surprised by the events. Whoever advised on Taoiseach to do this press conference made a grave mistake, because all it ended up doing was making him involved in the case, even though technically he was not, which is not a good look for the leader of a country. As I said, people had lost confidence in Charlie Haughey's government, and this was basically just the straw that broke the camel's back. Charlie Haughey would say at the press conference that he was not in a position constitutionally to ban Patrick Connolly from going on holidays. Haughey was berated in the media for not having spoken with the Garda Commissioner to get all the facts. There were calls for his resignation, people saying it showed gross incompetence by Mr. Haughey. Ironically, this would be the first time Charlie Haughey would be front and centre of a major controversy that he actually had nothing to do with. Meanwhile, Malcolm MacArthur was in custody awaiting his trial. And the burning question on everyone's lips was, despite everyone knowing he was eccentric, was he actually a psychopath? He killed Bridie for her car. Why go to such deprived lengths? He turned Donald's gun on him, knowing he did not have the money to pay him. Also, it transpired that when he was arrested, notes had been found belonging to him and in his own handwriting detailing his plans to kill a female relative for her money. Ultimately, MacArthur would plead guilty to the murder of Bridie Gargan, but he was never charged with the murder of Donald Dunn. He was sentenced to life in prison for Bridie's murder, but technically not one day was served for Donald. The state entered a plea of nulla prosequi, and I'm sorry if I'm butchering that word, which means basically that the prosecution entered a stay on criminal proceedings in the case of Donald. The deal was if he admitted guilt in the murder of Bridie, the state would not try him for Donald's murder, which to me is a bit of a travesty. But that was the agreement that was made. It did avoid a jury trial where MacArthur pleading guilty but insane was on the cards, which could have led to a lighter sentence. After his sentencing, MacArthur was brought to the basement of Mountjoy Prison, an area reserved for those who are not allowed to mix with the general population for their own safety. It was said that MacArthur was actually quite popular in prison and often enjoyed a game of pool with his fellow inmates. The events of that summer in 1982 had far-reaching consequences for the government, and they would ultimately be out of government by the following year. But the controversy that surrounded it, as well as the phone hacking scandal, followed Charlie Haughey and ultimately led to his resignation as an Taoiseach and leader of the Fianna Fáil party in 1992, ending his political career. In 2012, a 66-year-old Malcolm MacArthur was granted temporary release with his status under rolling review by the probation service. He had now served 30 years for the murder of Bridie Gargan. At the time, the former governor of Mountjoy Prison said MacArthur may have been released before now had there not been a fear within political circles of being seen as to be soft on crime. Malcolm was very high profile from day one. There was also the question that two people had been killed. He said MacArthur had spent a long time in prison, and that the authorities deemed him to be suitable for release on the basis of risk assessment. He went on to say, "In terms of that, I believe that it is the right thing to do, once people are satisfied. I have always had a difficulty that, in Ireland, it is still very much a political decision whether somebody is released or not. In many other countries, it is a judicial responsibility, and they put a tariff, which is a far fairer system, because you can imagine the dilemma. Who will have released him first? MacArthur had served a much longer sentence than the vast majority of killers in this country, with the average sentence being 17 and a half years. At the time of his release in 2012, a group called Advocates for Victims of Homicide called for a review of the law on mandatory life sentences for murder. They wanted judges to be given greater power to set sentence tariffs, a minimum term before consideration for parole that should be served. As it stands today, the Parole Board is an independent statutory body that can consider applications for parole from prisoners serving life sentences once the prisoner concerned has served at least 12 years of their sentence. New legislation brought in 2024, known as Life Sentences Bill 2024, gives sentencing judges a formal role in informing decisions on the release of life sentence prisoners on parole. In other words, when sentencing, judges make a recommendation on what minimum term should be served in prison before parole is granted. And the parole board will then be required to take that recommendation into account when they are making their decision. This recommendation is non-binding, and the parole board ultimately still are responsible for deciding when a person is released. So, after 30 years in prison, MacArthur was released. He seemingly now spends his days living in Dublin, going to bookshops and libraries, and basically living a quiet life. As of this year, 2024, he has still never apologised or explained why he did what he did way back in 1982, despite agreeing to several interviews after his release. In one of those interviews, MacArthur said he believed he had suffered temporary insanity when he killed Bridie and Donal, stating he did not want to be remembered for those notorious murders, saying he had lived a blameless life until the murders and has maintained his morals ever since. He went on to say, quote, "If you were to plot my life along a graph, morally speaking, you would see a very flat line for the first 37 years, then one sharp spike in the middle, followed by another completely flat line right up until the present day. I have committed the act of murder. I am somebody who has lawfully killed. That's an action that took place at one point in my life of 75 years. His reason for carrying out the vicious attack on Bridie Gargan, followed by the cold-blooded murder of Donal Dunn, his answer? There was a financial problem to be solved. Quote, "You must remember that this was a financial situation. It wasn't what you might call irrationality or lack of control. There was a problem to be solved, and you might ask me why salvage it in this particular technique. And that's a legitimate question. But it wasn't an act of madness." Unquote. He seems to be contradicting himself here, as at the beginning of the interview he is alluding to the fact that he had suffered from a temporary insanity episode. To me, his explanation is a word salad, dressed up to hide what essentially was an act, actually two acts of cold-blooded murder, of which he only served a sentence for one. The ramblings continue. Quote, "I recall thinking in the time before I embarked on the criminal venture that if, and the word if is very important here, if I were to apply myself to some important project and if I were to achieve something of significance, something that might be worth writing about, the inclusion in the narrative of an account of the mundane activity of having to make a living by earning money would, aesthetically speaking, constitute a blemish or an imperfection on that narrative. Therefore, the solution was criminality. And I don't mean aesthetically in what I would regard as the superficial, but in the deeper philosophical sense. This is the static sense of my life as a narrative. And that narrative had to be untainted by earning money. Because that was, in my mind, an inferior activity. Time not given to the higher pursuits, the intellectual pursuits, would have seemed to me to be degraded time." He continued by saying, "Now the crucial thing again is the sentence begins with if. If I were to achieve something important, had that sentence begun with when, then we would be in the realm of personality disorder, of grandiosity, megalomania, and so on. And there was none of that. It was a disorder, not of personality, but of thinking. I believe it was a form of temporary insanity, quite frankly. Now, guys, I think I have bored you enough with his ramblings. And that's all they appear to be, is ramblings. There's not one sign of remorse in anything he says. And you would think, having had 30 years to think about it, he would at least have the decency to apologise to the families of Bridie and Donal for taking their loved ones in such vicious circumstances. A petition of more than 10,000 signatures was put forward to the Minister for Justice to consider urging for MacArthur to be put on trial for the second murder. This petition, unfortunately, was unsuccessful, and MacArthur is a free man to this very day. On what was the 40th anniversary of her murder, Bridie was remembered by those who knew and loved her. The assistant matron of Blanchardstown Hospital saying, "From a nursing staff of more than 300, she stood out as an excellent nurse and an effective teacher of students during her 3 years here." Bridie was one of 11 children, and she had been reared on a farm in Dunshaughlin. Having gone to her local national school and then on to St. Michael's Loretta Convent in Navan, she completed her Leaving Cert in 1971. She then made the decision that she wanted to pursue a career in nursing. Bridie had joined the Specialised Coronary Care Unit at Blanchardstown Hospital in 1978 and, according to her colleagues, was a valuable, efficient and a competent member of the team. One colleague saying Bridie was a very nice person to work with and was well liked. She was studying coronary care nursing in 1981 at Richmond Hospital, having had to take a pay cut to do the course. She was awarded a gold medal for best student on the course. After finishing this course, she went on to do an 18-month midwifery course at Richmond Hospital. But unfortunately, she would never get to finish this course, as MacArthur made sure of this 3 months before she was due to graduate. But apart from her nursing career, Bridie had varied interest. She loved traditional music and attending trad sessions at O'Donoghue's pub near her home. She was also very interested in politics and worked as secretary at the local common in Curragh. People there describing her as very likeable and very efficient at her job. Her interest in politics came from her father, who was director of elections for Dunshaughlin. She also loved spending time with her family, often seen on a Friday evening driving down the winding roads towards her house, where she would enjoy a big family meal and a catch-up with her siblings and parents. I could not find much on Donal Dunn when I was doing my research, but what we do know is he was a young 27-year-old farmer with his whole life ahead of him when he was cut down so brutally on that fateful day. Dunn had met MacArthur that day at around 10:30 a.m. at the post office in the centre of the town and drove him to the bog between Edenderry and Rathangan so that they could test out the gun and he could show him how to use it. This bog was only a few miles from the town centre of Edenderry, and it was here that MacArthur would turn Donal's gun on him, shooting him before he even had a chance to defend himself. He then made a lame attempt to hide the body in brambles at the bog, before stealing Donal's car and fleeing the scene. Donal's body would later that day be found by a 7-year-old boy who was enjoying a family picnic on the bog at around 5 p.m. He had noticed a trail of blood which led to some undergrowth. He followed the trail and made the grim discovery. What a scene for a 7-year-old child to see. The trail of destruction left by Malcolm MacArthur is unbelievable. For Bridie's family, for Donal's family, for the country who at the time was living in fear that a deranged killer was on the loose, and for the government at the time, and especially on Taoiseach Charles Haughey, who was inadvertently dragged into the case because of the association between his Attorney General and Malcolm MacArthur. It is a case that has gone down in history as quoted by Taoiseach Charles Haughey as being grotesque, unbelievable, bizarre and unprecedented. At the end of the day, MacArthur was held accountable for Bridie's death, but not for Donal's. And to me, that is a travesty of justice. What do you all think?
So guys, that's it for today's episode of the Ireland Crimes and Mysteries podcast.
Again, thanks for your listenership, and don't forget to subscribe to the show and hit that auto download so you never miss an episode. Until the next time, keep your eyes open and your mind curious. This podcast has been compiled from information gathered in the public sphere, like news articles, documentaries, and open source material that can be found on the web. Everything in this podcast is alleged unless a conviction has taken place.
You've been listening to Ireland Crimes and Mysteries. Join Newells for another episode coming real soon. And keep up to date by following our social media sites, our YouTube channel, and our website, islandcrimesandmysteries.ie.